The Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone. For the sake of our technology, let's just make sure each of us can hear and see everyone participating today. That would be the three of us serving as judges, as well as counsel and opposing counsel. And we'll begin with Mr. Steck. If you could just say a few words and we can make sure that you are being heard.
Yes, Your Honor, and I can hear the court.
Very good. Mr. Steinhoff?
Your Honor, I can hear the court just fine. Thank you.
Excellent. And my colleagues on the court today.
Good morning. This is Judge Flory.
Good morning, everybody. I can hear everybody loud and clear.
All right. And counsel, I'm assuming you can see and hear the judges as well. Very good. Now you have the option, you probably know because everyone has become very familiar with these technologies, you have the option of a gallery view or a speaker view. And we've had occasions where lawyers have said they can't keep track of the time very well online, but if you maintain a gallery view, the clock, which appears in the screen of the marshal, will be much more, it'll be larger and you'll be able to see the actual time remaining. So I recommend that you maintain a gallery view. If you haven't already toggled to that, you certainly can now. Counsel, we are keeping an audio recording of the presentation today, not a video recording. So as is our custom, we ask that you announce who you are as you're making each leg of your argument. That way we can keep track of and others can keep track of who is attached to which argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes to make your case with an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal, and the counsel for respondent, you'll have a total of 15 minutes. Please be mindful of those restrictions as they will appear on the screen. Unless there are any technical issues, we'll just proceed along. If it turns out at any point, either you lose some audio or you have diminished audio of any of the judges or your opponent, please just signal by waving or speaking up and we can certainly pause the proceedings and the clock to make sure that everyone is back in line technologically. All right, with those preliminaries, counsel for appellant, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Jason Steck, and I represent the appellant Landmark Bank. Your Honor, this case is like Groundhog Day, the 1993 movie with Bill Murray, where a weatherman was forced to relive the same day over and over again. Not only is this case on appeal for the second time after a highly questionable procedural dismissal from the district court, but the substantive issue in this appeal is fundamentally the same as it was in a previous case involving a published opinion from this court, involving the same debtor, the same property, and the same type of a scheme to try to use an intermediary to transfer that property from himself to his wife to avoid judgment creditors.
Mr. Steck, let me just ask you at the beginning of your argument, am I correct in understanding that you are making no challenge in this appeal to the district court's findings on the fraud on the court claim?
Your Honor, we're not making a challenge to the, we're not claiming that there was a fraud on the court in the conciliation court case, because that conciliation court case was in Carver County.
But so, the district court ruled against you on that ground in its findings after this trial also. And I haven't seen anywhere in your briefing where you've challenged any of the district court's findings on that determination that you did not prove a fraud on the court as pled in this case.
Your Honor, we couldn't collaterally attack the finding of the conciliation court judgment from Carver County in this case. So we couldn't appeal the finding that there was no fraud on the court in the Carver County case.
Because the district court here ruled two things. It ruled you hadn't proved fraud on the court, and it ruled you didn't plead the financial transaction fraud claim under MOVTI. So are you challenging the district court's findings that you did not prove a fraud on the court as was pled in the three complaints here?
Your Honor, I'm having a difficulty answering that question clearly because I want to be clear about which court I'm talking about.
Well, I'm talking about the district court findings from your trial in this case that you did not prevail on the fraud on the court claim.
Yeah, our argument from the beginning was that this was not an attack. It was not a claim on a fraud of the court in Carver County. It was rather a claim under MUFTA, whereby that Carver County judgment was used as a tool.
Mr. Steck, let me stop you. In the three complaints that were filed in this case, there's an allegation that this was a sham transaction and a fraud on the court, which is a recognized type of fraud. And I don't see where you've briefed anywhere the challenge to the district court's trial findings that there was a fraud on the court here.
And ultimately, Your Honor, we concluded that the respondent was correct, that we could not collaterally attack the Carver court judgment. So we're not saying we did not proceed with a fraud on the court claim. However, the claim also stated a fraudulent transfer. And we did proceed on that basis. So we're not appealing the fraud on the court claim simply because we didn't proceed with a fraud on the court claim, because we can't make a fraud on the court claim in Washington County versus a claim or conciliation court judgment made in Carver County. We simply couldn't collaterally attack that through this proceeding, but we proceeded on the fraudulent transfer claim. And that was discussed at the pretrial hearing. Specifically, the district court had stated that there was the district court, first of all, prefaced the entire discussion with two quite open declarations of its inclination to dismiss the case on procedural grounds. The court stated that it felt that it had that the Court of Appeals' previous reversal of its dismissal on procedural grounds had indicated that the court had dismissed the case too soon the last time, and that the court said that it wasn't sure it was going to take the gamble again, indicating an intent to inclination to dismiss the case from the outset. And the court further said that it would love to dismiss the case. Don't get me wrong. And that will be in the transcript too. So the court from the beginning is looking for a procedural way to dismiss the case. Then, pursuant to the respondent's pretrial argument, say where the respondent had made a motion to exclude all evidence from Landmark acquisition, that discussion evolved into a discussion of whether or not there had been a pleading of a fraudulent transfer claim. And after counsel for the bank called the court's attention to paragraph 6C of the second amended complaint, the district court interrupted and said, yes, I'm looking at that right now, and indicated, given the notice pleading standard, that there was enough notice in that second amendment complaint that a fraudulent transfer claim was being made.
Well, that's not what the district court's order says that was filed as a result of that hearing. The order never even mentions a claim under the Fraudulent Transfer Act. The order specifically says that that the fraud on the court claim was pled with sufficient particularity to proceed. I'm looking at the order right now. I can't find any reference to a fraudulent transfer claim. And in fact, you told the court that it wasn't pled and it wasn't in the complaint.
Your Honor, to be clear, what I told the court was that the statutory reference was not in the complaints, but the fraudulent transfer claim was. And I had said that that's when I pointed the court to paragraph 6C, saying this is stating the elements of a fraudulent transfer claim. That's what the notice pleading standard requires. It doesn't require the citation of a specific statute. And that's what's inexplicable in this case, Your Honor. The court makes a pretrial ruling saying, yes, there's been notice made of a fraudulent transfer claim. And then when the order comes out, suddenly it's like that never happened. It's in the transcript. We can see it happened, but the district court simply, sua sponte and without any comment, reversed or ignored its own pretrial ruling that there had been notice provided of a fraudulent transfer claim. That's what we found inexplicable about the order, is that there was a pretrial ruling on a question of whether there had been notice of a fraudulent transfer claim that then suddenly just disappeared by the time that we had the final order in it. Now, the respondent says, well, you could have made a motion to amend, but course we didn't make a motion to amend. The court had ruled. The court had ruled that there was notice given. We were proceeding on a fraudulent transfer claim. And when you look at the transcript, it shows that throughout. We went through the elements of a fraudulent transfer claim exclusively when questioning Mr. Pokorny and Mr. Klingelhutz. That's the entire focus of the trial, was a fraudulent transfer claim. So it's impossible to conceive, or inexplicable to us at least, on how this evolved into a sua sponte dismissal on a failure to plead with specificity. Now, when
was it a failure to plead with specificity or failure to plead at all?
It was both. They said the court said you had failed to plead it at all in contravention of its original pretrial ruling. And then the court said, in addition, if it was pleaded, if I do look at this, it wasn't pleaded with specificity. And that's where that Lampert case comes in. When the court sua sponte makes a dismissal, and it's motion, it's important to note here that there was no motion to dismiss from the respondents for failure to plead this. They made an evidentiary case saying, please don't let the bank submit any evidence, but they never made a motion to dismiss. So this was a sua sponte act on the part of the court. And the Lampert case stands for the notion that that sort of a sua sponte dismissal is not a Rule 902 dismissal because there was no motion. It's a Rule 4102 dismissal. And it's an improper one because the court can't dismiss on the merits under Rule 4102. It can only do it for trial management reasons. For example, failure to follow an order of the court. So the court wasn't permitted to do a dismissal on the merits based on a sua sponte motion that the claim hadn't been pled or hadn't been pled with specificity. Now, it's important to note that this is the second time the district court has done this. The district court in the previous appeal had dismissed the case because the counsel for the bank in that case had failed to file a witness and exhibit list until the day before the trial. And the district court said, I'm dismissing it. And this court, in an order opinion, said that was an abuse of discretion and sent it back. That's the context that the district court's statements that it had dismissed the case too soon and it would love to dismiss the case again arise. And so then we are here in another procedural dismissal of the case, involving a court that just seems to be looking for reasons to dismiss this case without addressing the merits of the issue. And the merits of the issue, well, first of all, I'd like to deal with how this was pleaded with particularity. In page 21 of the appellant's main brief, notes 78 to 81 detail by reference to the Second Amendment complaint, nothing else, exactly how the elements of a fraudulent transfer claim had been pleaded. There was no specific statement of a statutory reference. We didn't cite the statute of the Fraudulent Transfer Act, but the elements were pleaded. And the rule under 902 is that in order to plead with specificity, you don't need to plead the statutory reference. There's no requirement for that. You need to plead the facts that create the elements of the claim. The Second Amendment complaint does that. It notes every single element of a fraudulent transfer claim. The parties on who it was being transferred from and to, that being a judgment debtor and ultimately his wife, and the fraudulent nature of the transaction, that being the use of an intermediary and a conciliation court judgment to create a, it turns out later, improper junior creditor to redeem the property.
But don't those allegations of alleged fraudulent activity, which I agree, there's certainly reason to question motivation here, but don't the allegations that you make apply equally to the pled claim of fraud on the court?
They apply to both, but they also talk about the transfer of the property, and that's not part of a fraud on the court. That's only a fraudulent transfer claim.
But in your fraud on the court claim, you specifically request relief to eliminate the transfer and restore all interest in the property to your client. So it seems to me you were requesting the same relief under the fraud in the court claim.
There are two different theories that are built into that. We don't contest that. But we can't make a collateral attack on a fraud on the court claim, but we can still proceed on the other theory, provided that there was notice given of the theory. And since the relief requested and the nature of a claim of a fraudulent transfer goes beyond just a fraud on the court claim, we did plead that additional element, and that puts them on notice that there's more than just a fraud on the court claim in the second amended complaint. But
nobody else understood that. The district court didn't understand that, nor did the other party. And the law seems to be clear that if a claim is not pled expressly, then the other party needs to consent to try the issue, and that consent has to be clearly indicated. Where is that consent clearly indicated in the record?
It doesn't require consent if the court rules that it's already been pleaded with us, that it's already been pleaded and that notice has already been given, which is what the court did on the record in the pretrial hearing. At the point that the court did that, what are we supposed to do? Say, well, just in case, we're going to make a motion to amend when the court's already said that we've given us, that we've given enough notice?
Mr. Stack, if I could jump in, what specifically do you think the court said had been pled with particularity?
That the court said when, Your Honor.
You keep referencing this transcript and you keep referencing the earlier procedural ruling. So I'm just asking you to be very specific. What was it that you think the district court ruled prior to the trial?
Yeah, in the reply brief from the appellants, I actually quote from the transcript at some length the discussion involving whether the Fraudulent Transfer Act had been pleaded at the pretrial hearing. And that's on page 2 of the reply brief, and it references pages 47 and 48 of the transcript. And what that says is that it acknowledges that the bank had not pleaded the statutory reference 513.44, but that the bank had pleaded the elements of a fraudulent transfer claim. And the court concludes this discussion by saying that given the notice pleading type of system we have, there is notice there.
Right, and that's my question. So looking at that transcript, if the next couple of sentences are important, maybe it'd be useful to look at those as well, because it's not just saying the notice, there's been notice there, and there has been notice all along. The court goes on to characterize what it thinks there was notice of in paragraph 6C. And it says, plaintiffs claim that Pokorny had no valid right to redeem. Ultimately, the court says the question is whether the bank can prove some type of fraud. And isn't that language, some type of fraud, a little bit more broad than saying that the court acknowledged there was a notice of a MUFTA claim? It just says some type of fraud.
Well, Your Honor, I'm out of time, but I would just note that fraudulent transfer claim is some type of fraud. Fraud on the court is another type of fraud. So our understanding of that ruling was that the court, since we were talking specifically about a MUFTA claim, and the court said there is notice there in response to that discussion, our understanding was that the court had ruled that there was notice of a MUFTA claim.
Thank you, Mr. Stack. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. I'll start out by answering Judge Flory's question to Mr. Stack, which was, is appellant appealing from the decision that the district court actually made? And the answer is no. There's no appeal from the fraud on the court claim that was adjudicated by the district court. You can look at their statement of the case that they filed with the Court of Appeals and their brief. And the only thing that they are appealing is this MUFTA claim that isn't in the pleadings. So prior to the trial here, there was more than 3 years of litigation. There was one appeal to this court. There were two amendments of the pleadings. And the first time that the words fraudulent transfer came out of anybody's mouth was at the pretrial motions in limine on a evidentiary issue that had nothing to do with the pleadings at all. The first time that the words fraudulent transfer appear in writing in the entire record are in the post-trial written closing arguments. There was a statutory reference, a random statutory reference to a provision of the Fraudulent Transfer Act, or the Voidable Transfer Act, I guess we call it now, in the joint statement of the case and appellant's trial brief, but those aren't pleadings. And the motion that Mr. Steck was talking about was an evidentiary motion relating to whether the bid by the bank at the execution sale that led to all this was an admission against interest that could be used against the bank. The district court was not asked to recognize a MUFTA claim. That wasn't before it. If you read the transcript, I think you can see that the district court and my partner, Mr. Crass, were completely befuddled as to why on earth Mr. Beck was talking about a fraudulent transfer claim when there wasn't a fraudulent transfer claim pled.
Well, let me just stop you there. And I'm looking at the exchange on the transcript where Mr. Steck specifically references the MUFTA, a potential MUFTA claim, by citing it to the district court, to which the district court says, right, I'm looking at that. And given the notice pleading type of system we have, there is notice there. And there has been notice all along that the plaintiff's claim that Pokorny had no valid right to redeem based on all of the pieces that led up to this. So can you address specifically that exchange and why that doesn't indicate the court's at least oral representation to the parties that there was a MUFTA claim considered by the court at that time?
Your Honor, I've read that part of the transcript and I don't understand what the district court is saying. I don't think she was indicating that, yes, there's a MUFTA claim. And I think it's obvious that if you look at her findings and conclusions of law after the trial, she obviously didn't think there was a MUFTA claim there because she said that.
Well, that's not my question isn't what the court referenced, what the court said later. My question is, I mean, if you put yourself in Mr. Stack's shoes and there's a representation to the court specifically of a statute that is referenced, and apparently the district court was contemplating whether or not this was a claim that had been pleaded, the district court expressly says, I'm looking at that, immediately after a citation to a statute. And then the district court says, and given notice pleading, the notice pleading type of system we have, there is notice there. So I understand you're saying that, well, you can't interpret what that means. What other reasonable interpretation might Mr. Steck make of it at that point for the sake of what further litigation, what further needs to happen? Should he have to file a formal amendment to include it? What else would he infer other than what he is asserting he inferred from this exchange?
Your Honor, there's a way to do litigation in Minnesota. If you want to assert a MUFTA claim, you put it in the complaint.
Let me go back to my question. Okay. And I appreciate that you have more that you like to argue and it may be persuasive, but I would like an answer to my question. What other reasonable inference could a lawyer in Mr. Steck's shoes draw from this exchange other than the one he's representing was a reasonable inference that the court recognized that this paragraph 6C claim had been pleaded all along?
Your Honor, I'm not sure how to answer that. She was making a ruling on an evidentiary motion about an admission against interest. I assume that she was referring to there is notice of the fraud on the court, fraud scheme that was described in the complaint.
How is that consistent with what the exchange is? I mean, you're saying, well, this is what we assume this is what she meant. I'm looking at the language. You're not challenging the transcript. You're not saying this is not an accurate representation of the exchange. I'm trying to get a sense of whether there is some other reasonable interpretation. And you're saying, well, you can't come up with one. And so if you can't come up with one, and Mr. Steck has come up with one that seems to be consistent with the exchange, are we supposed to come up with one on our own?
Your Honor, you know, at the end of the day, I think it doesn't matter. And I can explain why.
Well, before you do, you know, and let me ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Steck. Is there any meaning or importance to the next sentence in the transcript that starts ultimately, the question is whether the bank or acquisition can prove some type of fraud that led to the redemption? Does the phrase some type of fraud indicate that when the court's looking at paragraph 6C, they're looking at it far more generally than Mr. Steck's interpretation of paragraph C, which is specific to MUFTA?
I think so, Your Honor. I think she's what she's trying to say is there notice that there is notice of fraud on the court, and whatever she said is obviously not very artfully worded. And I'm not trying to criticize the district court. I'm having trouble interpreting the words on the page here, just as you are, but I think. That last sentence, ultimately, the question is whether the bank or acquisition can prove some type of fraud that led to the redemption is what she was trying to get at. And the answer that she came to is no. Plaintiff did not prove some type of fraud that led to the redemption. So when I indicated to Judge Ross that I don't think it matters, that's what I was trying to get at. She did make a finding in her findings of fact and conclusions of law that even if there was a MUFTA claim, the plaintiff didn't prove it. So let's just pretend here for a second that there was actually a MUFTA claim pled, which there obviously wasn't. But if there was, the only place it's described in writing is in the written closing argument, and it's described as a transfer to Doreen Klingelhutz, which is my client, John Klingelhutz's wife. And there wasn't any evidence.
Again, Mr. Steinhoff, if I could interrupt, and you know, you don't have a lot of time, so I want to precisely focus your attention when it comes to the merits of MUFTA and what the district court found or didn't. The question I have is, I'm familiar with the kinds of fraudulent transfers that we typically see with MUFTA claims, where a debtor tries to transfer some asset to somebody else so that it can't be reached by creditors. But that's not the identified transfer in this case. The transfer in this case is a debt transfer in order to put someone else in the same line as creditors. So I guess my question is, what specifically do you think is the fraud, the transfer here that that is the basis for the MUFTA claim? Is it the debt that allows a new creditor, Pokorny, to stand in line as a creditor, or is it a transfer of property from one creditor, the bank, to another creditor, Pokorny?
I think it's the latter, Your Honor, and the fact that we're talking about this shows that it wasn't pled, because why should we have to guess at what the transfer is in a court of appeals argument? I mean, that should be laid out in the complaint under Rule 9.02. But as I interpret the argument on appeal, the transfer here would be the sale by the bank and the redemption by Mr. Cornet. And that cannot be a fraudulent transfer under MUFTA, because it's not a transfer by the debtor. Under MUFTA, a fraudulent transfer has to be an asset of the debtor by the debtor. And that's Minnesota Statutes 513.44, subparagraph A.
So to summarize, your interpretation of MUFTA as a matter of law MUFTA does not apply to a transfer of property from one creditor to another.
It does not apply when the transferee is the creditor making the fraudulent transfer claim, both because it's not a fraudulent transfer under the statute and also because of waiver considerations. But we have a bank here that bid $50,000 at an execution sale, and my client, Mr. Picorne, redeemed for $50,000 plus interest and costs. So you have a plaintiff appellant who is also the transferee. And there's case law going back 100 years that says you can object to the redemption after a sale like this if you accept the redemption payment, which the bank did here. So if we're going to pretend that there was actually a fraudulent transfer claim pled here, it can't be a fraudulent transfer because of waiver, because the bank accepted the redemption payment and kept it. The transferee was not the debtor, Mr. Klingelhutz. It was the bank that did the execution sale. That's not a fraudulent transfer under the statute. And third, the district court said in her findings that there's no evidence that the transfer that was described in the post-trial written arguments, which also is not a pleading, there's no evidence that that transfer ever happened. So, you know, if the court wants to pretend that there was the right claim pled, there's three different reasons why the district court was still correct and why the district court should still have should still be affirmed. Getting off that topic, back to the question of whether this was adequately pled. You know, there's a right way to do things here. If you want to assert a fraudulent transfer claim, you put it into the complaint. If it's not there, Rule 15 says you can make a motion to amend. If it's still not there after the trial, you can make a motion under Rule 15 to amend the pleadings.
And let me pause you there. And that's to where I'm stuck on this, that yes, you can make a motion to amend. As I read this exchange between the court and Mr. Steck, I'm trying to put myself in the place of a lawyer and wondering whether there's a need to make a motion to amend. If I get the impression that the court has recognized that the claim already exists and under notice pleading that no amendment is necessary, I'm wondering whether just as a matter of process and fairness, it would be appropriate to disregard this exchange. And in the context of what not what it might have said against Mr. Steck, but how it might be interpreted in a way that favors his argument. Isn't that the way we look at this?
Your Honor, what about fairness to my clients? I mean, I think that's the fairness that you should be looking at here. I mean, we are talking about a motion on a evidentiary issue that is completely related to the pleadings. There's an exchange between counsel. It's completely indecipherable. It's to be fair to my client is to make an actual motion under Rule 15 to state a fraudulent transfer claim, which obviously is not in the complaint as it is written. You can read those pleadings 1,000 times and you would never come away with, hey, this is a fraudulent transfer case. I don't see how you can say you've pled a fraudulent transfer claim without citing the statute, using the words fraudulent transfer, using the words voidable transfer, describing what the transfer is in terms that would lead the other party, my client, would give that person notice that, hey, this is a fraudulent transfer claim, not a fraud on the court claim. My client didn't have any opportunity to do discovery on a fraudulent transfer claim. My client had no idea that this was a fraudulent transfer case until post-trial submissions.
Thank you, Mr. Steinhoff. I believe your time expired. I'll let you run over a little bit so you could make your point. If you have one concluding sentence, I'll let you go ahead and wrap up.
Your Honor, it's not in the complaint. There's a right way to get it into the complaint. That didn't happen. Since it didn't happen, they're stuck with the pleadings as written. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter because the court found that the fraudulent transfer claim wasn't supported by the evidence. And with that, I thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Steck, any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Steinhoff and I agree on one thing, is that the court did include in its ultimate order an attempt to address the merits of a MUFTA claim. That indicates that the court was aware, because of the way that the trial proceeded and because of the pretrial discussion, that this was, at least potentially, a MUFTA case. It tried to deal with the MUFTA issue, and that kind of points the finger at the types of notice that were there in addition to the second amended complaint itself.
So, Mr. Steck, let me jump in because you don't have a lot of time, and I want to hear your answer to the question of what is the fraudulent transaction that is that triggers the MUFTA claim. Because I'm looking at paragraph 6. Paragraph 6A says, the judgment between Klingel, Hudson, Pokorny is a sham and a fraud on the court. Paragraph 6B asks for a declaration that by virtue of his failure to redeem, defendant Klingel, Hudson has no further rights in the property. And paragraph 6C is a declaration that defendant Pokorny has no right to redeem. So it's not clear, looking at any of the subparagraphs of paragraph 6 in this three-page complaint, what specifically is the fraudulent transfer that is being alleged to trigger a MUFTA claim?
Your Honor, the issue of what fraudulent transfer was pleaded and what fraudulent transfer was proven at trial are separate. We pleaded generally that there had been a fraudulent transfer in the Second Amendment complaint. The types of fraudulent transfer that were proven at trial were two. The first of those is the transfer or the placement of Klingel Hutz in a position, Pokorny, in a position to do the redemption in the first place. That created a lien. And under the definition of transfer in the fraudulent transfer statute, the creation of a lien is a transfer. So at the point that Klingel Hutz went and asked Pokorny to go and get this conciliation court judgment against him, to put Pokorny in the position to redeem the property, that created a lien, and that was a transfer that was fraudulent because he's trying to get the property out of the hands of the judgment creditor. And secondly, the second transfer is the interrupted transfer.
Let me stop you there because I want to make sure I understand your argument. The definition of fraudulent transfer in MUFTA, according to you, would include the transfer from the debtor to a new creditor of a lien?
The mere creation of the lien encumbers the property. By getting a judgment, he becomes a judgment creditor. And that automatically, by operation of law, a judgment lien attaches to any property that is docketed in Washington County at that point. So that automatically attached. So the creation of the lien was itself a transfer under the definition in the statute. Secondly, the interrupted transfer from husband to wife, because the testimony from Mr. Pokorny and from Mr. Klingel Hutz at trial admitted that the entire purpose of transferring the property to Mr. Pokorny and putting him in a position to get the property was so that he could hand it off to Doreen Klingel Hutz. But the other thing about this that's interesting is that it was also admitted at trial that Pokorny didn't have standing to redeem the property, because Mr. Pokorny revealed at trial that along with the $50,000 that Doreen Klingel Hutz gave him to redeem the property with, he was paid for his judgment debt. At that moment, his judgment debt ceases to exist. He's no longer a judgment creditor anymore. He's been paid. So his redemption at that point is void. He doesn't stand in the shoes of a junior creditor anymore. He's been paid. It's like it's actually quite similar to a previous case from this court authored by Judge Ross, as a matter of fact, A&M Market, where a judge where a mortgage, the holder of a mortgage forgave his own mortgage as part of the purchase price for the underlying property. And at the point the court raised the question in the decision, what mortgage exists anymore? At the point that he's forgiven his own mortgage, he ceases to be a mortgage holder. The mortgage goes away, it's extinguished. So there's a third basis that this redemption is void. And that's because Mr. Pokorny was no longer a judgment creditor anymore. At the
before
point
before you get to that point, I still want to come back to the definitions in the statute. The definition of transfer refers to transferring assets, right?
Yes.
So if the fraudulent transfer here is not an asset, but some kind of a debt between Pokorny, who's acquiring a debt to then allow him to stand in the shoes of a creditor, then how is that satisfying the definition of transfer in the statute?
Well, the right to collect on a debt is an asset, but the asset that's at issue here.
But he's not transferring the right to collect on a debt. He's not saying someone owes me money and I'll sell you the right to collect that debt. He is owing Pokorny money to enable Pokorny to be a creditor. How is that a transfer of an asset?
The asset's the land. The transfer happens with the creation of a lien, first of all. That fits under the definition of transfer. It's happened, secondly, by engineering a scheme to transfer it from husband to wife through an intermediary, just like happened before with the previous Klingel Hutz case. I'm out of time.
Although you're out of time, I want to make sure that you have an opportunity to fully answer Judge Bryan's question. So you can continue to the extent you're responding.
Our argument here is that the asset is the property. And that's what's being transferred. The court, I would ask that the court not confuse the tools used to transfer the property, that being this judgment debt that was solicited by Mr. Klingelhutz from Mr. Pokorny to put him in a position to transfer the property. Don't confuse the tools with the asset. The asset's the land. The goal here is to get the title to the land from Mr. Klingelhutz to his wife, using Mr. Pokorny as an intermediary and using funds provided by Mrs. Klingelhutz herself. So the whole scheme involves a series of actions, but the fundamental asset that's being transferred here is the land, and it's being transferred from husband to wife.
Thank you. I believe that thoroughly answers the question, and we understand the position of both parties. Thank you both for your written submissions as well as your oral argument in this interesting case. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. The matter is submitted. Thank you.